Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. You, me, all of us have suffered through that really terrible genre of high school speech that starts with a definition. Like, Webster's Dictionary defines founding father as a person who helped to create or establish something. Fortunately, I've got no speeches for you. Just a look at the dictionary writer himself, Noah Webster. He was a furious innovator, someone who shaped America, and kind of a compulsive guy. Actually, a very compulsive guy. Here to talk all things Webster is Joshua Kendall. He's the author of several books, including The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Josh Kendall, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, first of all, why has Noah Webster, who you've looked at so much, why has he been largely forgotten?
Noah Webster was very crotchety. He kind of had a personality problem. In Ambrose Bierce, the satirist who kind of made fun of everyone in the early 20th century, defined hell as the eternal resting place of Noah Webster.
Yikes.
And he just alienated a lot of people. But in the 1850s, he died in 1843, he was really high up in the American pantheon. People would put him in the same sentence as Washington and Columbus. And the reason for that wasn't the dictionary. The dictionary came out in 1828 when he was 70, but the reason for that was the speller, Webster's Speller, which came out in 1783. And over the next century, that book would sell a staggering 100 million copies. And that book taught five generations of Americans how to read. So every American in the 1850s knew of Webster and also connected Webster to his or her own childhood. So he was a huge figure. And after the Civil War, people stopped using his speller in the late 19th century. And then by the early 20th century, when people like Ambrose Bierce were making fun of him, his reputation goes in decline.
Now, what do you think his most important contributions are? Is it the dictionary? Is it the speller? When you sort of now can look back with the benefit of hindsight and see how his creations took off and changed the U.S., what would you point to?
That's what I try to get at in the subtitle of the book, which is the creation of an American culture. We broke off from England in the 1780s, and Webster was the first guy to say, okay, now we need to have our own cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
Previous to his speller in the 1783, Americans had used British spellers. And Webster wanted to get American kids, this first generation, to think of themselves as Americans. So I think that's really the strand of his work from the speller in 1783 through the dictionary is getting us to think of ourselves as Americans. And he really also came up with American English, which is kind of a fascinating concept because we're the most ethnically diverse country on the face of the earth. But from California to Maine to this day, we all speak the same language, American English. And that's really his achievement.
So his idea about really, really making that break from Britain was it's language. You have to speak differently to think of yourselves differently.
And cultural, mm-hmm. and really uniting us culturally. And I think that's really his legacy. And it's one of those things that's kind of like Freud. It's so much in the air that we forget how valuable the contribution was.
What was his relationship with the founding fathers? What did he give them ideas? Did they give him ideas?
Webster was young, so he was born in 1758. As a comparison, Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the youngest founders, was born in 1743. So he was a teenager, and during his summer vacation from Yale, he fights at the Battle of Saratoga.
Who hasn't? It's a common summer vacation
during
type
senior,
of activity.
Right before his senior year. But he was a policy wonk, and the speller gave him kind of a national platform. He writes the speller at about the age of 25, and then he has this national platform, and he's writing pamphlets about America's political makeup, And in 1785, when we were under the Articles of Confederation, he writes an essay saying things aren't quite working out. We need a stronger central government. And he's a very enterprising sort. So he decides that he wants to go to the top and meet America's first farmer. And he heads down to Mount Vernon and shows Washington this idea. Now, Washington was a great delegator, and Washington said, sounds very interesting, young Mr. Webster. I think I'll give it to my Mr. Madison. And Madison used some of Webster's ideas in formulating the Constitution. So he's right in the background in the 1780s.
And you've written about a bunch of really productive, innovative people, Thomas Jefferson, H.J. Hines. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that a lot of these people have a kind of love or obsession with repeating things until they get them right. They want to make sure all their I's are dotted and their T's are crossed to a degree that I think most of us would think, wow, that is a little bit over the top. That's a little intense.
Yeah, I've written, as you're alluding, a book about America's obsessives, mm-hmm. about people with an obsessive personality who've been superachievers, Jefferson and Henry Heinz and even Steve Jobs, to use a contemporary example. But these people are a little bit unbalanced, and they have a hard time in human relationships. They have a hard time connecting. They can be very draining on their spouses, but they have this kind of persistence to get things right. And another way of putting it is that Webster was a little bit unbalanced. And for most of us, the task of writing a dictionary from scratch, and it's really amazing, he spent 30 years in this dictionary. For most of us, the task of writing a dictionary from scratch would give us a nervous breakdown. But for him, it may well have prevented him from having a nervous breakdown because it gave him something to focus on. And he could channel all his obsessional energy and make sure that he would just work as hard as he could until he got something right. But someone like that, if they don't have a project to consume them, can get very depressed. And at times in Webster's life, he did get depressed. And then he'd always find something else to do. But just the amount of energy he had was unbelievable. And he writes encyclopedias and writes bestsellers. He also ran New York City's first daily newspaper by himself for 5 years in the 1790s.
How is it possible that he's writing a dictionary, he's running a newspaper? Right. I mean, I know he had something to do with that first census that came around.
Yes, yes.
What was his role there?
Webster was an obsessive, and he loved to tally things up and to count. And he's also a very energetic marketer. And in the 1780s, to sell his speller, he basically goes on the first American book tour, and he goes around the country and hobnobs and gives lectures to promote the sales of his speller. While he's there, he has a very strange habit, which he'll go to a city like New York, and he'll count all the houses. He literally spends a day, and those cities were small, so in a half a day, four or five, he would count the houses, and out of that, he crunched some numbers, and his jottings in the 1780s were folded into the first census, which came out in 1790. He's doing the newspaper from 1793 to 1798, and it's like a 12-page newspaper, and he does it all by himself, and he even writes letters to himself.
He's writing the letters to the—he's the editor, and he's writing the letters to the editor.
And the letters to the editor are about all his own problems, like he has— You know, problems. Oh, he's shy with women, and he writes letters to himself and answers them.
But people were reading this, right? This is not just an internally circulating document.
Yeah, this was, and he was George Washington's right-hand man because in those days, newspapers were party organs. And George Washington knew Webster, had met him at the Constitutional Convention, and said, I need a guy in New York to help me with the Federalist Party. And Webster has this newspaper, and he runs it for 5 years. And then he sells the newspaper in 1798, and that gives him the money. And from the speller, he's making money, and from the newspaper, he makes money. So at the age of 40, he basically retires and spends the next 30 years working on the dictionary.
Do you feel like Noah Webster had this kind of unique moment to be really creative? Because, you know, here we are in a country that didn't have a distinct American English, you know, that there had been no census before. I mean, right, there's all these sort of opportunities to do things that you might be creative, but if you're in a place that already had these systems in place, you know, you have a very different set of opportunities.
Yes, I think maybe this whole question of American innovation, that, you know, we're not a country bound by convention, and people, you know, whether they're Silicon Valley techies today or Noah Webster in the 1780s, this kind of temperament of people who are kind of loners and a bit isolated without the great social skills, but with some kind of obsession to figure out a problem. You know, they kind of thrived, as you're saying, in the 1780s and 1790s, and they're also thriving today.
Let's talk for a minute about the dictionary, since that's how almost everybody, if you just said, quick, Noah Webster, what do you think of? That's what they think of. We've heard a lot about the Oxford English Dictionary and how it was created, which was very unusual, this sort of collaborative process of a crazy person writing in, and you had a sort of all these strands coming together. What was interesting or different about this dictionary and how it was created?
Right. Okay. The Oxford English Dictionary is now the late 19th century, so you're already into teams by then. But Webster is doing it in the age of what I call the one-man band. Before Webster, the towering figure was Samuel Johnson. And Johnson's book is very literary and has about 43,000 words. Webster's 1828 dictionary, which he does all by himself, you know, which is remarkable, has 70,000 words. And he's going to change the nature of the dictionary. And in terms of innovation, he also adds science and technical terms. And these sciences are exploding in the 1780s and 90s. He's going to add terms from chemistry and physics. And he's also going to modernize the dictionary by giving us examples. And sometimes the examples come from his own life.
And such as?
Like marriage. He's very religious. You know, his marriage is a compact between man, woman, and God, things like that.
But you said that one of the things Noah Webster wanted to do with this dictionary is sort of break from Britain a little bit and say we have a different language.
Right.
Did he go through and say, you know, we're going to spell this word differently, favor. He just was like, forget the use. I'm not interested.
Yeah, he did that. And part of it, Webster was also a very canny marketer. And he figured that if he changed the language a little bit and sold it in all 13 states, there were just 13 when he started in the 1780s, he figured that if he changed the spelling, it would kind of enhance the market value of his books. And he tries out all kinds of spellings. Some of them don't, like color and favor and those we use today, but he also tried an old English spelling for of bride, groom, taking out the R in groom. And he tried all kinds of eccentric spellings.
It's amazing to me to think that somebody would be writing a dictionary and just decide, you know, I don't think we're going to spell that word this way anymore. It's kind of like this incredible hubris to say, I'm going to declare it to be so, and I'm going to create a new word, and everybody will adopt that new word, and they will go forth and use it that way.
But that's exactly the character trait that's necessary for this kind of mega achiever. Without that hubris, I mean, it takes hubris to think that you can do a dictionary from scratch. I mean, and that's precisely what's needed. And that goes hand in hand with this supercharged dynamo and all that energy. And I said, most of the time, the hubris served him well. Every once in a while, got the better of him and he got a little bit delusional, but not too often.
Joshua Kendall is the author of a bunch of books, including The Forgotten Founding Father, Noah Webster's Obsession and the Creation of an American Culture. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.